Welcome to WISO Weekend, the home of WISO-produced news and features. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, music from local musician Kylene Downs. Antioch College officials tell us what's next now that they are a fully accredited institution, and a report from the Allegheny Front on leaking methane in wells throughout Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. That's coming up later in the program. Up first, just a few weeks ago, Doolittle Raider David Thatcher passed away at his home in Montana. Thatcher was just 20 years old when he flew on the infamous bombing mission that is credited with changing the course of World War II for the Allies. You can find details on that mission on our website at WISO.org, as well as the story of the Doolittle Raiders' annual toast, a celebration and a memorial commemorating the young men who never returned from that mission and of those who passed in the years after. In 2013, three of the last four survivors of the Doolittle Tokyo Raiders gathered at the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patt. They raised a final toast in honor of their accomplishment and to their comrades. They spoke with reporters before the ceremony, recounting the details of their mission. Here's Thatcher at the age of 92. He began by telling us how surprised he was that people still remembered and still held their mission in such high regard. And then he talked about his experience.
The raid was really surprised that we weren't met by more enemy aircraft. After we went over the coast of Japan, we were flying about 50 feet in the air, and the Japanese, we were flying so low that there was a lot of, after Saturday right at noon, a beautiful day, and quite a few people on the beach, and they were waving to us. We could see, I was flying so low, I could see the expressions on their faces. They were cheering, expected to be their own airplane, I guess. Then after we left the coast, we were flying at 50 feet off the ground all the time, and it was we met a formation of six planes, and they didn't see us. They just kept on going. It's difficult to see an airplane flying that low over the ground. So then when we reached to Tokyo, our target was the Nippon Steel Factory in Tokyo. So we had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded. And as soon as we dropped the last bomb, we dived down, went out over Tokyo Bay, and were headed for China. We did not fly over land, but we did fly, so we could see the mainland of Japan. Flew southwest until we reached the southern tip of Japan, then headed for China. That was a long flight, very long flight for a medium bomber. We were in the air for 13 hours, and that usually they only in the air about 5 hours. And then when we reached China, then the weather turned bad, and when we finally spotted, the pilot spotted a strip of beach, he thought he could land on there, so had the wheel down. And it was raining and just about dark, so we misjudged the distance, and we hit the water with the wheel down and immediately tipped us over, turned us upside down. None of them, they couldn't walk very that evening. We saw up on a bank there a couple of people, and we didn't know if they were Japanese or Chinese. It did happen to be a Japanese occupied island, but there weren't any Japs there at the time. So, and the Chinese underground, the guerrillas were operating on that island too. So they helped us up to a couple of huts there overnight. And about 3 in the morning, I went with two of the Chinese with a lantern, tried to get the airplane to get first aid kit. But by that time, the tide had come in, so I. So then the next morning, about daylight, I went back out again, but I couldn't find a first aid kit. So then I could see how much damage had been done to the airplane. And when we crashed, they tore both engines out with the propellers still attached to them and smashed the front of the airplane all the way back to the leading edge of the wing. So if they hadn't been thrown out, they never got out alive. So, Charlie, the guerrilla leader on the island, by the time he got up there, he had organized some bamboo pallets to fasten to bamboo poles, and then two coolies could carry them that way. And we left there at 11 o'clock in the morning, and 3 that afternoon, they landed a company of Chinese soldiers there and came looking for us. But we had a head start on them, and had started to cross the island, so they never caught up to us.
Considering everything you went through in 1942 and after, what does it mean to you now to be one of the final raiders and to have gone through the years with your brothers and the other men who are left?
It's really surprising and honored to be one of the final four. Yeah, glad that we're able to make it here. We live in Montana, so we got there.
And how does your family feel about your status in a raider and you being one of the final four?
Oh, they're pretty proud of us. Yeah.
Thank you for your service, sir. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Okay, thank you.
That day, I also spoke with Thatcher's son, Jeffrey, about the American legacy his father was a part of.
So tell me what this means for you. Your dad is one of the final four remaining Raiders. They've been through a lot with the first mission and over the years with these reunions. How what does that mean for your family?
Well, it's a real source of pride, and it's a real it got real emotional today as we were riding in the motorcade. The family members were in the bus behind, and we could see the Patriot riders ahead of us and the Raiders in the cars ahead of them, and then the people that were on each side of the road that were waving at us. It was just really heart-wrenching seeing all the flags that were waving. I mean, it just really personified America, patriotism, and really made me particularly proud that my father was a part of that. And, you know, and he's a really humble man, and like when we were growing up, we didn't know anything about this at all. I mean, he's just an incredible individual. I'm really proud that he's my dad.
When did you find out?
Not until we were in high school. He was just a real quiet, I mean, just like a typical member of the Greatest Generation. He just didn't, you know, they didn't brag about their exploits. They just felt like it was their duty, and they went and did it, and you know, just move forward with their lives, and just felt like that was part of what was expected of them.
Your dad is how old?
92.
92, and how old are you?
55.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Have you been to some of the other reunions?
Yeah, I've been to the last 8. I started going relatively late in life, but once I started going, I was hooked. I mean, it's like a big fraternity of family, friends, and all of us family members that are kids of the Doolittle Raiders share a common bond, and you know, it's like we're blood relatives almost, and it's just a real wonderful gathering when we get together every year and renew our friendships and participate in honoring our fathers.
Forgive me for this question, but do you think you'll continue maybe with other family members after these men are gone?
Yes. We've got an organization called the Children of the Doolittle Raiders, and several of us are active in it. And our mission is to carry on the legacy of what our fathers did. We don't want this ever to die. We want to carry it on. What we really would like to do is see it put in the educational curriculum of high schools where kids that are growing up are aware of what their sacrifice was. We want it to continue, and we're doing everything that we can, and we will in future years to carry on the legacy for them.
Any other final comments?
Well, tonight's going to be a really poignant moment because with the goblet ceremony and the guys that are still here, I know it's going to be a real emotional time, but I just feel so proud of my dad, and I feel so privileged to be a part of this and to be able to participate in it, and I'm really proud to be an American.
Thank you so much.
Sure, you bet.
Jeffrey Thatcher speaking about his father, David Thatcher. The Doolittle Raider passed away just a few weeks ago in June. And finally, here's just a portion of the final toast that day from a report we filed for NPR. In 1959, the city of Tucson, Arizona, presented the Raiders with a set of 80 name-engraved silver goblets. They're kept in a velvet-lined box, and after each year's toast, the goblets of those who have died are turned upside down. Four remain upright. This time, the Raiders bring out an 1896 vintage bottle of Hennessy Cognac. It was given to Jimmy Doolittle on his 60th birthday and has been kept unopened by the Raiders ever since. Lieutenant Colonel Cole is asked to break the wax seal. Not an easy task.
This is a tough one.
It's a tough one.
The 98-year-old finally succeeds, and the solemn final toast is made.
Gentlemen, I propose a toast to those we lost on the mission and those who have passed away since. Thank you very much. And may they rest in peace.
More than 71 years of tragedy, bravery, and inspiration have led to this moment. And finally, the Doolittle Tokyo Raiders declared their mission is over. For NPR News, I'm Jerry Kenney. With the passing of Doolittle Raider David Thatcher, there remains only one left. Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole, who you just heard make that final toast in 2013, Cole was able to make it to Thatcher's memorial service in Montana. He turns 101 in September. This is WISO Weekend. There are thousands of gas wells in the Marcellus Shale of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, and a growing number of pipelines moving that gas around the Northeast. How much of this infrastructure is leaking methane, a potent greenhouse gas? The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier tagged along with a team of scientists to try and answer that question.
It's actually a blue line with this green line, but you can't even see it anymore.
Naomi Zimmerman is checking a computer screen inside a white van that looks like it came straight from an episode of Storm Chasers. Zimmerman is leading a team of researchers from Carnegie Mellon University looking for methane here in the rolling hills of northeastern Pennsylvania. Computer monitors and expensive sensors are mounted inside the team's van, wind and weather probes on the outside. All told, there's $500,000 of equipment on the rig. To start her day, Zimmerman must first make sure the team's monitors are calibrated correctly. On a screen mounted to the dashboard, she reads off her levels.
So we're seeing readings of 0, 0.16, negative 0.1, /0.1, 1.4. That's approximately 0, good enough for...
With their rig checked out, the team is ready to roll. A few years ago, northeastern Pennsylvania was one of the hottest drilling spots in the country. Now, most of the rigs here are gone. But there are thousands of wells already drilled, and the hills and dairy farms around the region are crisscrossed with pipelines, compressor stations, and other infrastructure siphoning gas away from those wells. The team's first stop is about a half an hour away, next to a pipeline tucked onto the back edges of a local farm. They park their van and turn on the equipment. A minute later, scientists Asia Ellis and Mark O'Mara see a spike on the levels on their computer screen.
So we know that it's natural gas.
Wow.
Quite a large leak.
That is
oh my
so
goodness.
Big, yeah.
Yeah, 3.2 ppm.
That is super exciting.
It is exciting.
The team is picking up about 1.2 parts per million of methane, or about 12 times the amount they would normally see coming off of a well pad. Then they see the levels go even higher.
Just went up to 9 ppm.
Wow.
Wow. So this is a leaky pipeline right here.
These readings could help Zimmerman and other researchers answer what's become an important question: how much natural gas is leaking into the atmosphere? One of the benefits of natural gas is that when it burns, it produces far less carbon dioxide than coal, a fuel that gas is rapidly replacing as a source for electricity. So if you're burning gas instead of coal, that's good from a climate change perspective. But there's a rub. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, so...
If you're not burning the natural gas, then and you're releasing sort of pure methane into the atmosphere, the methane has a much higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide on like sort of a 25-year time scale.
Zimmerman's colleagues at Carnegie Mellon have found the EPA has been underestimating methane leak rates for years, but they're still not sure exactly how much of it is escaping the country's oil and gas system. Why can't they figure this out? One reason is the sheer number of places where gas can escape. Mark Bowling is a vice president for Southwestern Energy, one of Pennsylvania's largest natural gas producers.
Unlike other areas like, say, power plant emissions of CO2 from power plants, we're not talking about one big facility that you have one stack and says, well, there's your source, it's coming out there.
Instead, each step of the natural gas network contains hundreds of places where gas can escape. Bowling's company cooperated with the Environmental Defense Fund on several studies to better understand methane pollution. He says spending money on equipment that can prevent methane leaks is good business for his company.
That methane that we can save from going up into the air and going into our pipeline, whatever we get for that will help defray the cost.
The EPA and several states, including Colorado and Pennsylvania, have begun implementing methane regulations on the oil and gas industry. Bowling resists these types of regulations because, he says, they prescribe equipment for companies to use that may not be necessary or effective.
You're basically telling them I have 100 different sources, 20 of them are the problem, but I want you to replace all 100.
He says it's better to let companies decide how to reduce their own emissions. And there's evidence that companies are starting to take methane pollution seriously.
1, 0, +1, +2, +3.
That's audio from a satellite launch in India this June. Aboard the rocket was a satellite called Claire, equipped with high-resolution methane sensors. Stéphane Germain is CEO of GHGSat, the Montreal-based company that launched the satellite. His clients include ExxonMobil and Shell. Germain says these companies can make money with this data because in Canada, they're already subject to a carbon pricing system.
Industrial operators would be financially motivated to better understand their emissions so that they can control them and ultimately reduce them, because really what they're doing at that point is reducing their own financial risk.
Using satellites to measure greenhouse gases is a technique NASA has used for years. But with improving sensors, they may become more important in the search for methane leaks. Daniel Jacob is a Harvard climate scientist who uses satellites to measure methane in the atmosphere above the United States. Jacob says satellites could be an early warning system to help on-the-ground teams find and fix leaks.
Satellites can provide you with a detection. They can tell you, aha, you got a hot spot here. And then once you figure out from space that you have a hot spot, then you can dispatch ground-based instruments or maybe, you know, low-flying aircraft to figure out where this methane is coming from.
Jacob's last paper used satellite data with a resolution of 10 square kilometers. His current project is using Claire, which has a resolution of just 50 meters. Claire is scheduled to start sending methane readings back to Earth this fall. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Catch more reports from the Allegheny Front on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. How about a little music? Last night at Glen Helen in Yellow Springs, Kylene Downs and her band celebrated the release of their new full-length album, Maybe Sometimes. And WISO listeners were fortunate enough on Wednesday night during Kaleidoscope to hear Downs talk about that album with host Juliet Frumholt. They also played a couple of tunes live, and here's one of them for your Sunday morning enjoyment. This is Take Me On.
1, 2, 3, Gia. Uplift you so you can fade.
Kylene Downs, as heard on Kaleidoscope this past Wednesday. Her new album is called Maybe Sometimes. Antioch College is once again a fully accredited educational institution. This past week, the Higher Learning Commission granted the status to the college, which has been working aggressively to regain accreditation since it reopened in 2011. To find out what this means for students and for the future of the college, I spoke with Antioch College President Dr. Thomas Manley and Vice President of Academic Affairs Lori Collins Hall. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Dr. Manley, you've just begun your tenure here at Antioch, and receiving this accreditation status from the HLC is quite an accomplishment, but it's one that's been underway for a number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been telling people, I'm the quarterback that comes in at the end, and they say, just kneel down and don't blow it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the process. Lori, as Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs, you've kind of been involved in the nuts and bolts of this process. Tell us about some of the steps that Antioch has taken over the last few years.
The alumni were instrumental in just getting the college back and getting us in a position where we could even strive for accreditation again. And then from that point forward, the faculty and staff of the college really were instrumental in putting in place all of the basic pieces, from curriculum to student programs, student support services, recruitment efforts. And all of those are part of what we're assessed on. When we have our site visit, when we submit our documents, our PIF, our documents for candidacy, our site visit from the HLC team, and then ultimately when we address all the questions at the IAC hearing. So we've done a great deal of heavy lifting at the college. I think I came in at halftime, so a lot had been done before I arrived. But then Hannah Spearson and myself co-chaired the last half of the effort and moved the initiative.
This is quite an accomplishment for a number of reasons. We're not looking at a school that actually is reapplying for accreditation or fell into some issues. This is starting all over again at a time when a lot of institutions are struggling just even to stay on course. We had to go through this process as if we had never existed. And that was very demanding. And we had to do it in really record time. It's normally a six-year process. We did it in basically four
years.
It's also the best possible outcome as well, because we not only were successful in receiving accreditation, but we were placed on the most positive track going forward. So our next responsibility really doesn't come until 2019, 2020, and that gives us 4 years to continue to strengthen the school and build our enrollment.
Tell us a little bit more about what the Higher Learning Commission had to say about the college and the steps you've taken.
Well, it's a long letter, Jerry, but at the very end, the president of the Higher Learning Commission, Barbara Gelman-Danley, wrote and said, "Let me commend you for the passion of your alumni, the Yellow Springs community, the board and institutional leadership, students and other stakeholders. Your efforts clearly reflect Horace Mann's greatest quote, and you have indeed won some victory today."
Operating as an unaccredited institution presents challenges for the college as well as the students who put their faith into the college and have been attending classes here over the last couple of years. Tell us what this means for them and for the future of the college.
Well, you're right. For the students who have graduated in the class of 2015, it means that they are now sending out transcripts, and they didn't graduate from an accredited college, but now when someone goes and looks on the website at Antioch College, Antioch College is accredited. For the students who graduated just most recently, the date of this accreditation is aligned so that, in fact, they have graduated from an accredited college. So in both cases, it's significant, but especially for the students who just graduated.
With accreditation now granted, where will the focus of the college turn? You have a number of big initiatives underway. Does this just allow you to put more resources towards the other projects that you're working on?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, this gets us in many ways to the starting line. It's not the finish line. It gives us great momentum as we move forward to do what we had set out to do in the beginning, which is to use this this opportunity, this moment to not only reinvent Antioch College, but to contribute to a rethinking of the very model that small colleges are pursuing. And that's critical because it's a very challenging time for institutions of higher education. And we think that it's meaningful not only to our college and to our alumni community, but to the wider world of higher education.
We've been speaking with Antioch College President Dr. Thomas Manley and Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs, Lori Collins-Hall. Thank you so much for speaking with us, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Jerry.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, The Book Nook.
Take a trip to the far reaches of space, time, and music every Sunday night on Alpharhythms. I'm Juliet Frumholdt. Come along with me, and I promise I'll get you home refreshed and ready for the work week ahead. That's Alpharhythms, Sunday nights, 8 to 11 on WYSO.
Well, I look at it myself as the beginning, really, of an exploration. That's the reason we're exploring. You don't know what you'll run into on an exploration.